Welcome to Risky Talk, the podcast where we talk about risk and how to talk about risk. This episode is about how we should be communicating evidence during the pandemic, looking at the different responsibilities of the media, government, and scientists.
Crucial thing with public health advice is it needs to be simple. Explanations can be messy.
And without real communication about why should you be isolating if you're contacted, you're not going to get that.
And it's about trying to find the right public health message, also running in parallel with the science that backs it up.
Communicating science and evidence in a public health crisis like the current pandemic raises a huge number of really tricky ethical issues. We want the media to share crucial public health guidance while also criticising that same guidance where necessary and holding the policymakers to account. But can we have it both ways? And what about governments? They want to communicate clear and simple health advice. But how much do they acknowledge the sometimes complex and uncertain evidence behind some of that advice? And finally, for scientists and academics, should they publicly challenge evidence, or does that risk undermining the measures intended to keep us safe? It's a minefield, as many of us have been discovering, and everyone has been having to find their way through. But what can we learn from the last 6 months to help us go forward into the next six and other public health crises to come? I've got a brilliant panel of guests with me who've all been in the thick of things in different ways. Victoria McDonald is the Health and Social Care Editor for Channel 4 News, and she's been reporting on the crisis from the beginning and is recording from the rather noisy news desk at Channel 4. Victoria, welcome to Risky Talk.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Tracy Brown, OBE, is the Director of Sense About Science, an organisation which campaigns for transparency in policymaking. Welcome, Tracy.
Hello.
And finally, Christina Pargel is the Professor of Operational Research at University College London and a member of Independent SAGE, a rebel group of scientists offering evidence-based policy advice to the government and whoever wants to listen as an alternative to the official Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, which we've heard a lot about here in the UK. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you. I'm not sure we're rebels, but... Thank you anyway.
So each of you is an expert in a different part of the communication process with a range of different audiences. So Christina, let's start with you. You're a scientist communicating science to policymakers as well as the public. Can you tell me a bit about your role with Independent SAGE, why it was set up, and how you see the scientist's role in communication during a public health crisis like this?
Sure. I mean, I think with Independent SAGE, it was set up right at the end of April at a time when we didn't know SAGE membership, there weren't any SAGE minutes, and it became increasingly impossible to tell, you know, when the government said we're following the science, to assess that, you know, were they following the science? And it felt like, you know, they'd moved by that stage from the kind of very clear stay home message to stay alert, which was a lot vaguer. And so the kind of thing was set up to try and communicate what we knew about COVID, to have a conversation with the public about kind of policy options over the coming months, but also to kind of provide just advice on what we thought could be ways forward in the pandemic. And it was always intended to be kind of constructive looking forward and not kind of critical looking backward. And my role, I mean, I'm guessing I was asked on because I do a lot of mathematical modelling in healthcare, although I'm not an epidemiologist. But my role has become a lot more about the communication side. So, for instance, since the government stopped doing its daily press briefings, we've started a weekly briefing on Friday where we kind of just go through the latest government figures and just explain them. And, you know, I take that really seriously. I think it's really important that I get it right, but also show where we don't know things, where data is missing, as well as what data there is and what it's showing.
So how much do you think your role has changed to communicating directly to the public rather than giving government advice?
So when we first started, we didn't really know, you know, exactly where it was going to go. And it just seemed that as we started, the more we carried on, the kind of the less the government was doing in terms of communication and the more confusing things got. You know, you had the Dominic Cummings thing, which muddied the waters in terms of communication. Then you had lots of openings. You know, you had schools, shops, bars, and now gyms, face coverings, where there's been a lot of really confusing messaging. And so what we've been really trying to do is say, well, look, this is the evidence that we know about COVID. And as far as possible, we try and use SAGE bidits that have now been published to kind of support that evidence. And this is what it might mean. And these are the risks and these are the potential benefits. And we've started these kind of public consultations on YouTube, where you know, members of the public can come in, they ask questions, we take questions from Twitter, we respond. And I think actually that's been quite unique. And it seems to have created what we've got quite a following now, people saying, you know, we really find it really useful, the kind of explanations you're giving.
So you're exploring communication as a two-way process.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, I'd like to come back later to how you dealt with the media. So we'll come back to that a bit later. And I'd like to move over to Tracy. So your organisation, Sense About Science, has been advising government on better communication of its scientific reasoning and decision-making process. You know, how do you think the government, what do you think they should be doing in this context about telling the public about why they're doing what they're doing?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges here is the way that government internalizes the public that it's talking to. You know, what Sense About Science does is we make the public interest case for sound science and evidence. So that's the perspective that we're looking at this from. And the challenge we have is that the public that is internalized by government, particularly when you have such a huge centralization of comms, communications, as you have managing the pandemic, is one that you sell a message to. So it's not one that is interested in the evidence. But, you know, there is a public that's kind of missing from government communication, which is the one that I think encapsulates most of us at the moment, of trying to reckon our way through what does this mean for me, the many different kind of risk messages that are coming across, what we're seeing around us, what our common sense might tell us, and so on. And that's something that I think is missing. So my concern is that that's got worse. What started out very much with a tone of leveling with people that, you know, we really don't have the facts at our fingertips. We're going to find our way forward. The best we can say at the moment is we're getting the best advice and this is from whom. And then, you know, from there, what you've seen is this kind of concentration of control and messaging in a way that just does not open up the discussion in a way that people need in a much more nuanced way.
I know that Sense About Science has always had their ask for evidence campaign, you know, way before this crisis, of you know, in a sense saying, encouraging the public to demand the reasons for, you know, what's being recommended for them or what they're being instructed to do.
Yeah, and that's been a very good thing. But I mean, who do you ask? I mean, that's been very difficult, actually. There were no public-facing government platforms for sharing information in a way that would actually respond to people's questions, no interaction. The daily press briefings was all there was. And you know, I don't think they were very satisfactory for journalists, never mind the rest of the public. So, you know, now I think Parliament's got its act together. That's at least a good thing. And, you know, there are MPs now raising those questions through the floor of the House. And you've also got, you know, the committees becoming very active.
Very interesting. Now, I'd like to come to Victoria now as a news and health journalist. You're often communicating science to the public, acting as its intermediary between all these different, you know, communicators and their audiences. How do you see yourself in this role? You've got the government, you've got the scientists, you've got the public. What is your role when it comes to encouraging the flow of information between all of these?
I saw my role at the beginning as, well, obviously trying to weave my way through some of this, or this barrage of information. And I also saw my role as needing to be pretty calm and measured, especially at the beginning when people were frightened, and trying to distinguish between the scary stuff that was coming out and the more practical briefings that we were getting right at the very beginning. It was enormously helpful. And you've had that feeling that you, even if they couldn't answer your question, it was because they probably didn't know the answer rather than that they were holding things back from you. Of course, that has changed as the pandemic has gone on. And our need for transparency has become even greater. The tension between the politics and the scientists has become ever greater. We have had to go to different sources like Independent Sage or the Science Media Center and to speak to the scientists themselves rather than trying to take the government interpretation of the science. The messaging has been very difficult, and as the person that is meant to convey that messaging, it has sometimes been an absolute nightmare.
I think this is extraordinarily important. You know, all of you have raised the issue of listening to the audience, getting feedback, understanding their concerns, but also the difficulty of actually doing this in practice. And maybe this hasn't actually improved as the crisis has gone on. Now, this podcast is called Risky Talk. So let's talk about the communication of risks. This is incredibly difficult, of course, because we're talking about people dying, and thinking about these health risks can be very frightening. And communicating the real size of these risks is difficult. On the one hand, you don't want people to overestimate it and be over anxious. And on the other, you don't want people to be careless. Now, Tracy, you've recently co-signed a letter accusing the UK government of failing to be clear about the risks. How do you think the risks should be communicated by government?
Well, I think there are three things. One is that, quite simply, there is a reluctance, clearly, to talk about things that are low risk or lower risk. Obviously, there's always that defensiveness of being afraid that you might say something that then turns out not to be quite that true and all that kind of thing. And being accused of underplaying a risk feels to politicians always far worse than being accused of overplaying it. So I think that's kind of the modus operandi of government at the moment, is to behave that way. The problem, of course, is that people's real lived experience isn't that. So that, you know, it is that it's much older people who are most at risk. There is a danger that if you're very generalised and not telling younger groups that they're far less at risk of having serious disease and of dying, then that, you know, you flatten out that risk, and then perhaps people aren't taking as seriously the quite extreme threat to much older groups, particularly those with underlying conditions. So I think that's the first thing, is just to be much more clear and differentiated. I mean, indoor-outdoor risk is a good example of that too, which is that, you know, studies are finding that sort of in the region of 97 to 99 point something percent of transmission events have happened indoors, or if outdoors, then in the kind of confined spaces, you know, like events that have sort of similar conditions to indoors. That again, you know, at the same time that's going on, we've got politicians being derogatory about pictures of people crowding on a beach. Again, very confused kind of messaging about what's safe where and so on. So I think some just straightforward clarity about those risks would be good. I think the other thing that is needed is a bit more information for people about what is being factored in. Vitamin D deficiency appears to be a really big part of this picture. Does government know about that? Is government, you know, are ministers taking that into account? Is it in their briefings? I mean, that's the kind of thing that people need a bit more information about. What is government thinking about, and how is it weighing up different factors? And then finally, I think there's a feeling of lack of candor about the way that different types of risks are being traded off. For example, the concerns that people have had about the people who have not been going to hospital for other conditions. There's definitely some evidence that's pointing to some pretty unpleasant outcomes there. The concerns that people have about the huge impact on people with dementia, of being socially isolated, the concerns being raised about children not being in school in terms of development and so on. And so I think those sorts of trade-offs, people are assuming government's making them, but we don't know whether on what basis they're making them. And so I think that is a very important area for, you know, more straightforward conversation.
Something I've been very interested in is the low risk case, because there is this massive gradient in terms of the risk to the individual according to their age, and younger people, particularly school kids, are actually of extraordinarily low risk, which I've pointed out and have been criticised for. And do you feel there's been a deliberate policy in fact to not to say that to people because it might lead people to say, oh, well, young people say, oh, well, I don't care, it's nothing to do with me, I'm just going to go out and ignore all these messages.
Yeah, and there's the irony, isn't there? I mean, that a time when government is asking for people's trust, what it also communicates is that it doesn't trust the people with the information. And this idea that people will, you know, this sort of zoning in on a handful of people partying in a pub and things like that, that's the kind of picture of this wanton, you know, abandon with which people have behaved. And so I think there's an element of that. I do think there's probably somewhere, in some cases, a lack of confidence with the data and governments. So I think there is a lack of confidence in saying clearly to people that, you know, this is where the risks are most worrying.
Oh, well, I'd like to come to Victoria on this then, because you're communicating to the public. How have you found reporting the government claims about the scientific basis for their decisions when actually the government, they're not scientists? You know, how have you found that?
Well, it's been very difficult, of course, and it comes back to this tension between politics and science. And you could also see at one point where the ministers were beginning to think, oh my God, what if we've got this wrong? Okay, we better blame the scientists. And so it was all about that whole thing at the Downing Street briefings of saying, we're following the science. And of course, then you couldn't see the science, which proved very frustrating until SAGE started publishing its papers, but they were somewhat after the effect. So the interesting one there was on schools, for instance. So we got those papers on the day that they announced the school closure. So you could actually see what had been discussed at SAGE and compare it with what the government was doing and what the political decisions were as opposed to the scientific decisions. And where there has been difficulty with transparency has, on the whole, been on the political side.
I'm very interested in this because I've also been intensely irritated by the briefings. And this phrase, following the science, makes me want to scream and shout, because it's not as if it suggests that science is some monolithic body of facts that's leading the way and telling everyone what to do, when it's far from it. You know, this is uncertain and contested. I've been trying to think of a better phrase. It's something like, we're listening to scientific opinion, might be a fairer from a political perspective. Christina, this obviously is so relevant to Independent SAGE. I'm just wondering how have you managed with dealing with the media, with reporting to the public, with being that voice for this independent group of scientific opinion?
I mean, I have to say, like, the media side of it was something I wasn't expecting. And everyone on Independent SAGE is now on the media quite a lot. The others more than me, but, you know, and I haven't really had much experience before this. And I think part of it is because you just don't have many of the SAGE scientists going on media. You don't really have the government commenting. And so there has been this kind of thirst from news and radio, TV to kind of go on and explain things. You know, and it's been things like from Newsnight to, like, I went to the Daily Mail health show. And a lot of it is just literally trying to kind of condense what I've done from reading the SAGE minutes, from reading the evidence, from listening to my experts on Independent SAGE, to looking at all the government data and reports, looking at what's going on around the world and trying to condense it and say, this is where we are. This is what we know about the risks, you know, so a lot of stuff around social distancing, duration of contact, indoor versus outdoor, face-to-face versus side-to-side. This is where we are in terms of infections. This is what we don't know. This is how well test and trace is working, kind of mediocre. And this is where we are in comparison to other countries and where we could be. And that's kind of ended up what I've been doing. And some of it has been quite standard kind of public health messaging, which is a bit odd as a mathematician. But on the other hand, like, someone has to do it. And I feel like if I have a platform to be able to say to people, please try and remember, you know, hand washing, don't touch your face, it's a bit of social distancing where you can, then I should be doing that.
You've actually found yourself in the role of giving people public health advice. But we know that's so difficult, because for public health messages to be effective, they've got to be clear and simple and trustworthy. And that's pretty easy for uncontroversial advice like hand washing. But what about where we're dealing with this new virus, where the evidence can be very uncertain? You know, what about face masks? For example, classic case, scientific communities, there's quite legitimate argument and discussion about the uncertainties. But does actually airing that discussion undermine or enhance public trust in the evidence and their willingness to wear masks? So, you know, how can these discussions be held?
I can start, because Independent Sage literally just released its document on masks, face coverings. We had a public event where we took questions from the public and explained our position, which is that we do think face coverings should be used, that there was a lot of uncertainty in the evidence. The evidence still isn't great, but the balance of evidence has grown towards masks being a good public health intervention, mainly in protecting other people from you if you're infected. But we emphasize that it's not a silver bullet, and it has to come with a big public information campaign on how to wear them, when to wear them, what kind of materials, that it's part of a suite of other kind of protective behaviors like social distancing, hand washing, not touching. So it has to kind of come together, and it has to be done in a way that's not punitive, so that there are people who legitimately are not in a position to wear face coverings, and we shouldn't be kind of creating a situation where they're attacked or feel ostracized because of it. We have to understand that. So in a way, that's kind of how we've been trying to do it, is say, okay, well, face coverings is one part of how you would protect your population from COVID.
So, Christina, you're describing a direct communication from the science community to the public.
Yes.
Victoria, so how do you think the media should deal with these sorts of discussions about the evidence? Do you feel that there's, you know, a conflict between the public health message and this nuance?
Well, it comes back to the whole messaging problem, in a way, is that you needed one or two very succinct, very stark messages to persuade everybody to socially distance, to stay indoors, to protect the NHS. And I think as the pandemic has gone along, it has become clear that that this hasn't worked entirely well in terms of the subtleties that lie behind it. I don't feel has been particularly well communicated. And maybe it's because I know that the government polling showed that, for instance, stay at home, protect the NHS played very well. But maybe there is a way of making the message more subtle now, but people have become used to this pandemic and used to the idea that it requires something from all of us. And it goes back also to this idea of, differentiating risk. Because you could tell young people, yes, you are less at risk, but what you can't tell them is how much they put at risk their grandmother. And that's where the communication becomes very difficult.
So, Tracy, do you think the government and some sections of the media have underestimated the public's ability to take on this nuance around evidence and messages?
Well, by and large, I think people are pretty good at that stuff. The best people to take care of your grandmother is you. And I don't think that when you look across what's been causing the high numbers of deaths in the older age group, it isn't the reckless behaviour of their grandchildren. People have really taken to heart that need for social distancing. You've had people who haven't met their new grandchildren until sort of 6 weeks or 8 weeks in, or still haven't. And so I don't think there's any reason from anything that we're seeing around us in terms of people's behaviour to be overly concerned that people haven't got the message on that one. And it's quite possible, in a sense, by emphasising who isn't at risk, you can also emphasise the, incredibly higher risk to older people. But David, can I say something about this whole sort of mask situation and also being communicated there. The purpose of the government's introducing masks into shops is ostensibly, and then what I hear behind the scenes as well, to get people to be more confident about being able to go back out, because 60% in polls are saying that they're scared of going, you know, and conducting themselves in normal life. Government's big concern is to try and get everyone back into normal life to try and reduce the economic risks to everybody and so on. But what, of course, happens is that we take our risk readings from the things that are going on around us. And if we see everybody covered in masks, then we start, it actually reinforces the idea that that's a very dangerous place to be, is in your local supermarket. And I think we need to look at that imbalance. If the government's purpose here is to give people more confidence, I'm not convinced that actually mandatory mask wearing is going to deliver us that. It might deliver us other things that people are saying in terms of transmission, but I'm not sure that it's going to convince people.
Well, that question of what is the aim of the communication is a really key point here. You know, at the Winter Centre, we're always banging on and on about the difference between aiming to inform people and aiming to influence them, to change their behaviour. As you say, public health information, and in fact, almost all of what a government is used to doing with its communication, is trying to influence and persuade. Perhaps it's been a bit too successful with persuading people to stay at home. And what you are aiming for changes, of course, what success looks like to you. So can I go around the table and ask, what would you see as a measure of success for different kinds of communication? Tracy, what do you think the government should be trying to achieve in its communications?
Well, I think at this point in time, it's quite an enabling thing, isn't it? So, you know, people are very aware of the need to resume some of their activities, all of their activities, particularly when it comes to work. You only have to have a quick scroll through Facebook or Instagram to see the extent of people's troubles with having kids at home for 24 weeks. And I think it's an enabling thing that people need in terms of day-to-day life. And many of us, in many ways, take responsibility for other people too, which is some of us, you know, have managed other people or have employees or colleagues to look after, run buildings, all sorts of things like that. So I think at the moment, you know, that there is a real hunger for decision making, and you see it at the level of local authorities as well, trying to sort of decide which events can go ahead and which can't. We're making many, many decisions from individual level through family, through community, up to government. We're making so many decisions, or having to make so many decisions, and people do not feel like they've got what they need at their fingertips.
So it actually very matches what we try to do when we're giving health, you know, helping people with health advice. Crucially, that people feel that they've got the information available to enable them to make an appropriate decision.
Yeah, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we're all going to agree it's the right
one. Yeah, it doesn't mean you're all going to do the same thing, but at least you feel you've got the better information. Christina, what about you? You know, the communication that you're doing both direct to the public and to the government, what would be a success for you?
The success for me, honestly, is if the government improved its own messaging, because they're the ones that should be explaining to the public about what's going on. And for instance, so they, you know, they've launched this test and trace system, but how many people actually know that if they have symptoms, they should get tested? If you go right now to gov.uk coronavirus, it has 5 bullet points at the top, and it doesn't mention getting tested. It says, stay at home if you've got symptoms. And you have to really search through the pages before you get advice on that. And the whole way it works is you have to find as many people as you can with COVID and ask their contacts to isolate. And we're not doing that. We're not capturing how many people that we're not testing. And we also aren't capturing how many people are isolating at the other end. And isolation of contacts is an entirely voluntary thing. And it's a really hard thing to do when you feel totally well. But that is absolutely key to stopping spread. And without real communication about why should you be isolating if you're contacted, what are the benefits? How does it work? How does it help? How can we help you do it? You're not going to get that. So it's that kind of criteria that I would measure success on.
And apparently, good messages, appropriate messages prominently provided.
Yeah, and also to kind of disadvantaged groups or ethnic minorities. Like, we know that they are much less aware of even the symptoms of COVID, social distancing measures, all of that stuff hasn't really been provided to kind of different contexts.
Victoria, I mean, what, as a journalist, how do you measure your success?
Well, I think the channel measures the success, but I did get promoted partway through this, so I'm hoping that's an indication of, that I'm doing a reasonably good job. Right at the beginning, I also took a decision to say on air, I don't know the answer to this. As time has gone on, I can't say that because there are many avenues now that I can go to. But right at the beginning, it was such an uncertain science, such an unknown virus. I took the decision that I needed to be honest and open about where we could get the information and when we couldn't get it. And of course, because I come from New Zealand, I look very closely at what's happening there and desperate hope that I can one day get back to see my parents without going into 2 weeks quarantine. And I've been very impressed at the messaging there, which was at the beginning, look, we just don't know. It's still too uncertain. And I think that needed to play a bigger role there because everybody knew that it was a new virus, that there was a great deal of uncertainty, and also that some advice at the beginning would change as the science became better. But just picking up on the we're running in a parallel way. There's the public health message, and it's about trying to find the right public health message, also running in parallel with the science that backs it up. And so for it to be really successful, you need to have them say, for instance, this is why it's 2 meters here, why it's 1 meter at the WHO, why it's 1.5 meters in other countries, and have it much better explained, rather than just us journalists, we journalists having to say it, to actually have it there in the public health messaging.
But I suppose I'm interested in the both things you said there. First is the need to acknowledge uncertainty, something we go on about all the time, about being open about uncertainty, because that's part of being trustworthy, but also the need to give, in a sense, confident messages out to the public. And they are quite difficult to reconcile. I mean, Christina or Tracy, do you think we can communicate uncertainty without losing trust? And if so, how do we combine that with confident, clear messages to the public?
Well, I think that the crucial thing with public health advice is it needs to be simple. In the sense that when it's directive, it needs to be kept quite clean and tidy. I mean, so we know this from the past of communicating risks to pregnant women. For example, we know that when there were attempts to try and tell them about every little thing they might have heard of as potentially posing a hypothetical risk in pregnancy, what happens is you see a drop off of people taking folate, which is because what they start to do is pick and choose from the list of risk mitigations that are presented to them, which is kind of a similar worry we have now, isn't it? That hand washing kind of disappears down the list of 20 other things that you've been told to do that are a bit more complex. So directions should always be really simple and kept to the minimum of the most important ones. They should be really prioritized. Explanations can be messy. And I think that's where you share, you know, in an accountable way. This is about accountability for your decision making. And that's where you share the different things you're taking into account, the different weight that you're giving them, and, you know, create the expectation that that can change. And one of the things that I think, both Victoria and Christina have sort of referred to this in different ways at the start of the pandemic, was there was definitely we were all in this together. There was a public expectation that new stuff would emerge and the picture would change. And I don't think that's particularly gone away, actually. If anything, I think we're all sort of looking forward to seeing what's going to emerge about, you know, the next year and how, you know, the whole discussion about herd immunity coming back and so on. So I think there's an openness there. One of the most exciting things, I think, about the kind of discussions that people have got into is so many people that you would never have dreamed of being in a discussion about the nature of uncertainty with are up for it. I had an online discussion with a bunch of MMA, you know, cage fighting warriors, about this question of uncertainty in the data. I mean, it wasn't a discussion I imagined having at any point in my 20 years of trying to talk about risk communication.
Okay, we're coming to the end now, and I'm going to wrap up by asking a simple question to each of you, maybe not so simple. What do you think has been communicated well, and what's been done very badly during the pandemic by all the different sort of actors in this drama? Let's start off with Tracy. What do you think the government has actually done quite well, and what do you think it's done really badly?
I would say, just to emphasize what I just said, the hand washing message at the beginning was good, was really, really good, really clear. Everyone got it. What has been probably the worst communication has been around schools and school children, and there, you know, there's been talk of super spreaders, there's been all sorts of things going on that are just patently untrue. And I think government has given no serious leadership in this area, either to the communication of the risk or to the management of the risk.
Right. Okay. Victoria, what do you think the media have got right? And what do you think the media has made a bit of a mess of?
I can't actually think of a mess. I'm sure other people could, in a way that I think media has, on the whole, been quite responsible in its reporting. And I think part of that has been that we have had very good background briefings. We've had the briefings from you guys. We've been helped along the way. Also, it helps to a degree that many of us have been health journalists or science journalists for a long time. So, from my perspective, you know, as awful as this is and as distressing and frightening, I personally feel this is all my years of health journalism coming together, you know, being able to understand epidemiology, communication, public health messaging and so on. It's been interesting.
Victoria, I can't resist asking you then, how do you feel as a health journalist when the political journalists start getting to ask all the questions at the briefings and so on? What do you feel about the political journalists or the general journalists getting involved in all of this?
Yes, well, those briefings were a little bit frustrating, not least because Channel 4 News quite often didn't get a question either from the political editor or the health editor, which was a bit sad. But yes, there was a frustration on our part because we felt, I think, as health journalists, that we would have had more direct questions to the chief scientific advisor or the chief medical officer rather than trying to score a political point, as it were.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Can I also say that as someone who's been trying to work with the media throughout this, it's been going in general very well indeed. I think partly because the media, they so need the scientists that they've been quite nice to us. Okay, so Christina, what do you think? You know, I know it's a huge thing. The scientific community is a great, massive, diverse thing. What do you think they've done well, and what do you think in terms of communication? And what do you think has been communicated badly? Do you think
the scientists that I have seen on the media or in newspapers, I feel like actually they're doing a pretty good job of communicating how much this is a new disease and how we're learning about it and where the uncertainties are. What I think has been done less well, and I don't know this is the job of the scientific community, is explaining how, given the uncertainties and the evidence, how you then make decisions. You know, so given that, say, we had uncertainty around the role of children in transmission of COVID, how does that then feed into whether you decide to open schools and how you do that safely? So I think that has kind of been missing. Can I just say one thing that about my bugbear of communication in general is this idea that we should all use common sense. Because I don't think there's anything commonsensical about a pandemic.
Yeah,
we're actually being asked to do things that are deeply unnatural, like not hugging people, not talking to people face to face, staying away. You know, I just think common sense is actually counterproductive and really, really unhelpful.
So let's sum up. We all agree, I think, government, scientists and the media, we all got similar roles when communicating in a public health crisis like this. Because, you know, when the evidence is clear, uncontroversial, you know, like hand washing, we can be clear and simple in the message, you know, aim to change behavior, but of course, giving people the reasons behind the messaging too. When the evidence is uncertain and emerging, we should be upfront about that. Tell people what we know, but also what we don't know at the moment. Try to update it as quickly as we can. But in the meantime, try to help people weigh up the risks and the benefits to make the decisions they need to. And when difficult policy decisions are being made, everyone should be transparent about the basis of the decision. The one harm is always being weighed up against another benefit. It's quite a change for governments, not used to this kind of messaging. And it's hard for journalists, many of whom are having to deal with really in-depth scientific research for the first time. And it's hard for scientific researchers too, who may not be so used to communicating to policymakers or the public. So it's not surprising that many mistakes have been made. I just hope that some of these lessons might be useful to communicators of all kinds in the next few months or even years. And it's many thanks then to my wonderful guests, Victoria, Tracy and Christina, for helping us through this most difficult of topics and at such a busy time too. It's goodbye from me and the Risky Talk team.
Risky Talk is produced by Ilan Goodman at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication in the University of Cambridge.